It's the True Faith Podcast. I'm Alex Hurst, joined by Simon Campbell tonight, and we've got, once again, very special guest. Matthew Raisbeck joins us live in Seaton Delaval to talk through his season as chief commentator for BBC Radio Newcastle. Matthew, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
No, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about what has unfolded over the past 48 hours with Rafa Benitez as well, and his future and the speculation linking him with West Ham United. So, Si, do you want to take us away?
Where am I taking us?
Oh, don't know. Well, anywhere you want. Anywhere you want to.
Just not to West Ham.
Yeah.
I guess just an overview of what's the season been like with Rafa. I mean, we've as a fan base, we've seen more ups and downs in the space of 38 games, I think, ever before. Like, we've seen Rafa buzzing. We've seen everyone buzzing. We've been through 9 defeats in a row and showing real signs of cracking. And then the last 4 games before Chelsea, we saw a really pissed off Rafa Benitez, and everyone was kind of like, oh, we're going to end on a really sour note here. Just kind of for you, how's it been, the ups and downs?
Ups and downs, yeah, that sums it up, really. The highs have been fantastic, haven't they? Obviously getting back into the Premier League and then going on a decent run after losing the first 2 matches. And then, you know, you look at the highs since Christmas, some of those results and performances have been fabulous. But the lows, the 9-match run without a win, October, November, December, the last 4 matches before Chelsea had you concerned and you wondered where they were going to finish. And obviously that has a financial implication as well, but they managed to get into 10th spot. So it has been very up and down. But obviously here we are again for the 3rd summer running. We're not sure where Rafa Benitez is going to be, because we had it after relegation. He stayed. We had it last summer as well. And then within a week of the season ending, Mike Ashley put out that statement. And we've had another statement from Mike Ashley, but obviously we've got the West Ham situation now. So here we are again, you know, on a downward curve potentially with Newcastle. But that is just the club, isn't it? It's up and down. I think the season as a whole went far better than anybody could have realistically expected. And think back to the sense of trepidation that was there last summer when the players weren't coming in and the manager was exasperated. And then you lose your first 2 games, Huddersfield in particular, and the windows open and there's still the transfer issue. And they didn't sign anybody after that Huddersfield match, because Hosseluu came in after Spurs and before Huddersfield. And then you were really worried. So to go from that point to finish 10th, to beat some of the big teams, to get some great results, to play the way they have individually and collectively, means that on the whole, it's been fantastic. But within that, it really has fluctuated, hasn't it? You've had every emotion possible. But that's football. That's why we love it. And that's Newcastle United. And will it ever be different? No, of course it won't. It will never be different, because that is just what the club is.
Yeah, I mean, you've talked about some of the big games there. I mean, for you, was there a particular favourite of this season? I mean, we've talked about this on our end of season show, and there's quite a few to pick, and we couldn't really choose. But was there
to choose, wasn't it? Yeah,
yeah. As commentator, was there a particular favourite?
Well, Spurs' first match of the season was interesting, because the first thing you noticed was, whoa, this is quicker, and this is better football than last season. Yeah. And then you think, all right, yeah, you know, you're back in the big time. West Ham away was really gratifying, and here we are talking about West Ham again, but the circumstances of that victory and the magnitude of it were, I think, really, really meaningful. You know, Henri Seve gives the ball away for a goal and then goes and puts a free kick in. I mean, we didn't even expect him to start. And they won that game with a team that would never have been anybody's first choice for a Premier League match. And it got them into a position where they were out the bottom 3 at Christmas, having gone in the week before by losing to Arsenal. So that one for me stands out. And it was their new ground, West Ham, a new stadium. Dramatic game, the penalty save. It was Christmas. Everyone was happy. And I think the obvious other one is Manchester United at home, because it just, again, it was just so meaningful. It had gone into the relegation zone at kickoff. I didn't fancy us. John Anderson, who does the co-commentary for BBC Newcastle, as soon as he got to the ground, said, I fancy us today. And he's not, it's normally the other way around. I normally think we're going to beat everybody. And he's, no, I'm not sure about this. And he was right, happily, and I was wrong. And they were brilliant. Everybody was brilliant. it was just to beat Manchester United is always special, but it meant so much more this time. And obviously Arsenal and Chelsea, you'll never forget, and winning at Leicester was hugely significant. But I think West Ham away and Manchester United at home were by far the best results. There's been some obviously disappointing results and some games that haven't been so memorable or so good, but those two really stick out for me.
Am I right in thinking that you commentate on every single game?
Yes.
So that you're pretty, in terms of people who've seen what's gone on, I mean, even your fellow journalists, you know, probably haven't been to every single game, so there's not many who've been able to see the team live as often as you. I'm sure there are one or two fans who do every single trip, but definitely not many. No one I know certainly has done all 38 plus cup games.
And the EFL Trophy.
Really, the EFL Trophy?
Oh, we were there for that, right. Yeah. That was an interesting experiment.
Yeah. Could be a big fixture in the EFL Trophy next season when League One Sunderland take to it.
With their first team, yeah.
Yeah, with their first team. My question was going to be, have you enjoyed this season more than last season? And if so, why? And if not, why not? Because obviously we won a lot more games last season. So which would you prefer? How have you preferred?
That's a really good question, because it's a difficult one to answer. Because I think whenever you follow your team, you want to see them win rather than lose. And there will be some fans who may well say, well, the championship was better because week after week we were winning. I know there were a couple of poor runs in that season comparatively, but being in the Premier League is where you want to be. It's where Newcastle United should be. We all feel that. We all know that. That's certainly what Rafa Benitez thinks. That's why he stayed, and he only wants to take the club higher in the Premier League. So I think everything has meant more this season because they're in the Premier League, but last season was in the Championship was just about doing a job. So you got the gratification from knowing that it was job done. This year, I think it's just meant that little bit more when you're able to go to clubs who are mid-table in the Premier League, who've got more money than Newcastle, who spent more money, who have been in the Premier League for longer in their current spell, and going there and playing well, and then it makes you think, yeah, you know what, we're back now, we're on a par with these teams, we can overtake them and get back to where we were and where we all feel that the club should be. So in that sense, I think this season's been more enjoyable. If from a media perspective, and my colleague Nick Barnes at BBC Newcastle, who does Sunderland and previously did Newcastle for 5 years, says that he's noticed after 10 years in the Premier League with Sunderland, there's so much less hassle in the Championship because there's not as much live TV, there's not as much media interest. So his job is easier, and of course there are more games to report on and commentate on. But when you're in the Premier League, there are international rights holders. I think at the weekend, Italian TV were there, I think French TV were there, and they all want a piece of the post-match action. So from a media perspective, it can get quite complicated, and after a game, things can be elongated because there's so many people there, whereas the Championship, and obviously for Nick, League One next season won't quite be like that. So that's the side of it that he and I see, but nothing beats winning in the Premier League, does it? And especially the way in which Newcastle have won and some of those results as well.
I mean, I'm quite shocked that Italian TV and French TV won't be interested in the fortunes of Sunderland in League One next season, but that'll be a shame.
To be fair, they were probably there to see Chelsea.
Well, Conte, yeah. But then Rafa speaks Italian and managed two Italian clubs, so I think he may have done an interview with them as well. He did speak to some Italian media, didn't he? And there have been some quotes knocking around at the start of the week, so maybe it came from that, but that's what you get at Premier League games now. I'm sure Norwegian TV were at one of the matches earlier in the season. Because it's obviously a global game and a global brand, every match is shown somewhere, and often in several countries at once, and sometimes they have English speakers come over and do the interviews. So that's the nature of the Premier League now. It's very different to the Championship. And of course, every match as well is filmed with multiple cameras. So in the Championship on Channel 5, sometimes you get one camera, whereas this season we get the luxury of seeing everything several times from several different positions. And those are the things, little things that I guess for fans, when you're trying to watch a game or watch the highlights, that you notice when you don't have all the camera angles, things like that. So, you know, little differences like that in the Premier League.
Do you think that, having seen all the games this season and worked closely with Rafa and seen a lot of what's going on, do you think that this team is the 10th best in the Premier League? Do you think we've earned 10th place, or do you think we've kind of we've overachieved? Do you think that's way better than we should have done?
They've given absolutely everything, and they deserve all of the praise they've been getting. I think they've exceeded expectations, but there is some quality there, and that quality plus the commitment and endeavour, the attitude and the instructions from the manager, you know, make it a team greater than the sum of its parts. And that's what got them higher in the table. You know, it was goal difference that did it at the end. So he was vindicated, wasn't he? Manchester City, home and away. And, you know, that in terms of prize money, I think if they'd lost to Chelsea, would they have been 13th?
14th.
So what's that, £8 million that one match, you could say, has got them? Because didn't Bournemouth ship a few to Manchester City? West Ham obviously lost heavily. I'm trying to think, Watford were in the mix as well. So
I think I saw somebody say on Twitter the other day, actually, that even if we'd lost like both games to Man City by 4 goals, we still would have been above these teams on goal difference.
Yeah,
such as the season we've had.
Palace were the other ones. Yeah, because they obviously had a great run, and Roy Hodgson did incredibly well there. Yeah, he's got them there, but the players have done their best. And the thing is, it's about a team this time, isn't it? And give me this team any day above the one that we had, you know, in 2013-14 when we finished 10th. And then it was a failure because they'd had a great run, hadn't they? And were 6th or 7th in and around Christmas time. And it all just fell away, didn't it? That was, I think, the year Remy would have been in the team playing up front. Pardew was the manager. It was obviously the headbutt with David Myler at Hull. And it all just fell away. And they'd done so well that they were able just to sort of not move and stay 10th. Whereas this time they've really had to work for it and kind of scraped in there. But I'd much rather have this team giving everything, doing their best with this manager, than obviously that group and doing it in the way that they did, because then they underachieved. Now they have, you would say, overachieved. But when you look at it like that and compare it to that season, it's been fantastic. And you can take so much pleasure out of the way that they've got to 10th this time.
I think it's the same for any club, the way that you do the season. You look at Leicester, bad end of the season. If their manager had come in later and got them to 9th place, I'm sure he wouldn't be in any danger at all. But the team you mentioned then, 13-14, I think we got 48 points, which would have us 7th nearly now, just below Burnley. And it's weird, isn't it, how the context of the season's kind of stats. It's like Everton and Allardyce. If you look at the stats, you did an all right job. Stats don't actually tell you all of the story. I'm sure, you know, they're useful in the league table. But
isn't this a record low points for 10th place?
Robson's first two seasons, 51 and 52 points. That, again, you'd be up in 7th place now. But that was a disappointment, not the first season, but the second season was really disappointing. I mean, we're all similar age, I think.
Twice.
But we were much younger, but I still remember the disappointment in that second season and the sense of underachievement. And it's a good job Twitter wasn't about then and stuff, because people would be angrier, and there was no suggestion of him losing his job or anything like that.
But you do remember, like, we lost 8 games or something in a row this season, and then 4 near the end. We've had some lots of defeats, and yet we've still finished 10th. And it's just when you think about it like that, there's a lot of games we've lost, a lot of points we didn't get. So just the Premier League, there is a gulf, and the top four get way more points than everyone else now.
Do you think, Matthew, that the players felt at any point as if they were a relegation threatened side, or did the self-belief ever seep out of them? I think it was 8 defeats and 9 side that run you're talking about. I don't know how many defeats it was. It was four,
and then a draw at West Brom, and then another four. So they lost 4 in a row 3 times this recent run, and then those 2, October, November, and then again in December. So, I mean, like you say, to do that 3 times in a row, 3 times in a season, 4 defeats in a row, and then, get 10th is incredible, but...
Yeah, do you think, because you interview the players every week, was there ever kind of a sense of despondency there, or was that self-belief evidence?
There was definitely an air of concern because of the results. What Rafa Benitez would always say is that if you look at the matches and go back to Burnley, which I think was the first one of those defeats, that was a Monday night, wasn't it, in October, could have gone either way probably. They shaded it 1-0, and then you had Bournemouth at home, who won it in the last minute. And obviously Manchester United away without Lascelles. And I think we know the stats about Lascelles and the goals conceded when he wasn't playing. So, yes, and Chelsea was in that run as well. But I think most of those games, apart from Watford at home, which was a bad one, they just lost narrowly. So I think they always felt that they were in touch. I remember Everton at home, they hit the woodwork twice. Everton scored once and then Allardyce just shut it all down, killed the game and they got the 3 points. So while they were never getting battered every week and it was tight in that sense, I think they always felt that they had a chance because they weren't far away. But when you're losing, obviously you are going to be concerned. And I understand that the level of alarm among the fans, because we felt it too, watching it and thinking, can't lose today, surely. If we lose, we'll be in the bottom three, or we'll only be a couple of points clear. And then you lose, and then you are increasingly concerned. But that's why I picked West Ham as a match that's so memorable, because it just put an end to that run of defeats against a team that was down there as well. And that, I think, really signalled the change. You lost to Man City in the next match, but then after that, drew with Brighton, beat Stoke, and things, started to improve from then on in. So, they were concerned, but even privately, even when you've switched the microphone off, no player said, we are really worried. Yes, the confidence is going to be lower when you're losing, that's obvious, but I don't think there was, because they were in touch and a lot of the matches were tight, I don't think they ever felt that they were, really, really in trouble. But you look at the table and they were, and they had to deliver. And this team, 2 years running, when it's mattered, has really delivered.
No, good answer. And I suppose the same thing applies to the just 60 minutes. Anytime you want to stop, just stop. If you've got to take a call or text, I'll edit this bit out. But
That was nobody. You can leave that bit in. It's fine. Right. It's nothing important. I can't read it out.
That was nobody. It's definitely Rafa.
same applies to Rafa. How is he consistent with you throughout the season, or does his mood reflect what's going on the pitch?
He's brilliant all the time. Before the match, after the match, when they've lost, he doesn't have a lot to say. We were at Spurs at Wembley, and I remember he did his radio interview with us, three or four of us there, and it was about 3 minutes, which in terms of a radio interview is not that long. Normally, after a good result, you'll get double that. He went and did his main press conference with the print media, and he was probably 3 minutes again, because he doesn't have much to say when they've lost. He doesn't really want to talk about it. Obviously, it hurts him. Before the match, he's wonderful. And what you see from him is what we get. There's no act. He is, he is as gregarious and as sincere as he appears to anybody that hasn't met him when they see him on TV or read quotes from him in articles. And he's very generous with his time, and it doesn't matter whether the team's winning or losing, he would talk to you all day, and he'll talk about bad results and bad runs, particularly before the match. He's very expansive and he'll explain why. He loves his stats and he'll put some of those in. Sometimes when you stop recording, he just gets even better. And, the things that obviously he will talk to you about are really interesting and really revealing. Sometimes it can be about nothing related to football at all. But even during the bad runs, he was still making time for the media and chatting for 10, 15, 20 minutes, after you've done the interview, about football, about other things. And what you always got was that this is somebody who just loves football, who loves people, but really enjoys his job. Might not enjoy the results when they're not going well, but absolutely loves the challenge of managing Newcastle United. And that is true. And what we're hearing now, obviously, about his future is concerning, but he wants to be here. He wants to stay. And we've never got the impression at any point this season that this is somebody who's looking for a way out at all. All we get is the impression that this is somebody who wants to be here for the long term. He was frustrated by the poor form and disappointing results, but he was always focused on turning it around. And I think he always had the belief that it would turn, belief in himself, his methods and the players being able to harness that. And he's just a joy to work with from a media perspective, particularly for radio as well, because I think in Spain, you know, radio is really seen as quite important. So he brings that across, and he's very good with us and very generous with his time. And he's just great to work with. We're very, very lucky to have the access that we do to him. And I think it makes you realise just how lucky Newcastle United is to have him as the manager, and hopefully for this season and beyond.
What was the thinking behind the listener's chat, Albert, whose idea was that? How did it come about?
Well, this has gone down a treat, actually. Albert from Wooler, who rings in Total Sport on BBC Newcastle regularly, really popular just because of it. You know, he's in his 70s. He's watched Newcastle a lot. He's quite no nonsense. He's got a nice thick Northumbrian accent, and it's just what he's quite memorable. And people text in saying they enjoy his appearances, and he came to visit us from Wooler in North Northumberland earlier in the year. And we just thought, wouldn't it be nice, because he can't go to matches anymore, if we could get Albert to meet Rafa. And we had a think about it, and we put it to the club. Look, can he, you know, come along to the press conference on Friday, just meet Rafa, maybe, you know, to sort of shake his hand. And they said, look, Rafa's fine with that. Come along, you know, he can have a chat with Rafa. He can, you know, ask some questions. And that was it. And again, that just shows you, you know, you've got a manager who's won the Champions League, he's at Newcastle United, and he'll give 10 minutes plus to a supporter who's travelled a long way to meet him for a piece of content for a radio station and their social media outlets. And he treated it seriously. He let us film it, put microphones on them, you know, treated it like he would any other interview. And yeah, we just got Albert down to ask Rafa some questions. He asked him about Mike Ashley. He asked him about if he's going to stay. He talked a lot about young players and transfers and certain individuals in the team. And it was, you know, he sort of asked the thing that he can get away with, which some people in the media maybe wouldn't ask so directly, because it's a completely different setup. But yeah, it was just an idea that we had. They decided to frame it as though I couldn't go to the press conference on Friday. They said I was queuing for boy band tickets, which was not true. I was there as well, but we had to present it to Albert in a way that, you know, made it seem like, you know, he would have the chance one-on-one with Rafa, which we did. And again, another sign of how good Rafa is, we still did our, him and I and Graeme Courtney from TalkSport, who's usually there, still did our usual 10-minute piece with Rafa on top of that. And then after he did us, he did TV, he did us, he did Albert, he did national and local newspapers, he did The Chronicle. He then spoke to Guillaume Balaguer from Sky. So, you know, this is a couple of hours after training that he's making for media, because he understands it's important. But like I say, he just makes time for everybody and will talk to people about football, about Newcastle United. And it's very, very rare that he will say no to anything. And I think that's just a measure of the man. And, you know, just how good he is from a media perspective to work with, and how accommodating and understanding he is.
It's really interesting to hear you say how different he is before and after a game, especially if we've lost, and how open he is compared to the 3 minutes you might get with him with after. And he's not, from our perspective, he's not very good at hiding his emotions post-match, because you can see the buzz when we've won a game, and you can also see how furious he is if we've lost, and just depending on the manner of the defeat and if it's a performance issue or if we've been done over by the referee or whatever it is. But the other thing you notice in Rafa is he's just a funny man, and mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to ask you, what has there been a particularly funny moment this season, like that's really memorable, or is there anything that you can tell us that's happened?
Well, just on your first point there, obviously after a defeat, I've just gone through some of the pre-match media commitments, and a lot of these are contractual. You know, we have a contract, BBC Newcastle, with the club for access to the manager one-on-one and players and commentary. And obviously newspapers do and TV do as well. So he has to do all of that. And he's got to do that after a match, win or lose. So it's obviously when you've lost, you don't want to talk. But even after a match that Newcastle have lost, in the corridor, in the media suite, he'll still meet supporters. And it was after the West Brom game, the most recent home defeat. There was a young lad there, and he came over to him. There was pictures. He signed something, pat on the shoulder, little chat. So, you know, he put it aside for that, and he doesn't take it out on people, but he'll still make time for fans no matter the result. And I guess a lot of managers do that as well, but just when you see somebody of his caliber and stature doing that at Newcastle United, again, it just serves as another reminder of what a fine manager and fine person he is. In terms of sort of funny moments, he is funny, and he's opinionated, and he'll talk to you about football and various things going on in football. But before we do our radio interviews, and I think this is a radio only thing, but I believe he did it at Liverpool. He says basically, because he is Spanish and speaks to us in English, we have to speak to him in Spanish. So I did Spanish at school for a year. I really should start learning it properly. So every week before the interview, I have learned, or so I think, a phrase or a question in Spanish. Something that I say to him, put to him. So he comes in the room. We actually do the interview in the groundsman's office. And Mick, the groundsman, sometimes comes in and out when we're doing the interviews. But again, Rafa, no problem. Great with all the staff. And he will come in and say, come on, come on. So I'll give him something in Spanish. And he's, right, sit down. And then he just pulls it apart, tells me that it's wrong. And we have a colleague at work who is from Madrid and who grew up in the same estate that Rafa's mother lives in now. And she's been to one of the press conferences, so you can imagine his delight at that. And they had a long chat about that, which is one of the many things he loves to talk about. He drew me a map of Spain once before a press conference, because I can't remember what we were talking about. We've obviously done the Catalonia issue. We've talked to him about that. But yeah, if it wasn't that that triggered it, but he drew a map of Spain and drew on the regions. And then I've still got it in my bag. I'm not going to get rid of it. And that's just because you get him going on one thing and suddenly he gets his teeth into it and he wants to, you know, go over it in detail and make you learn something. So whether it's a phrase or a question, are you going to go on holiday this year, Rafa? Because you didn't go on holiday last year. That's something that I asked him a few weeks ago in Spanish. He really, really just picks it apart. He analyzes it. And even if it's right, he'll say, that's good, but you could have done it like this. So if he's like that with us, yeah. Me and Graham Courtney from TalkSport, who used to be Newcastle press officer in the 90s and, you know, someone that Rafa actually knows quite well, away from Newcastle United. Can you imagine what he's like with the players when he's got the DVD out, when he's got them in a room for a meeting, individually or collectively? You know, he'll have 20 minutes with us on the geography of Spain, or the way that you use a certain verb in Spanish, or stresses on vowels and things like that. You can imagine how in-depth and detailed and thorough he is with the players. You know, just analyzes to the nth degree. Everything, absolutely everything. But it's brilliant to see, and it's a privilege to be in and around so frequently.
Before we get on to Rafa's future and your thoughts or opinions on that, is there a ground you've enjoyed being back at or visiting this season? Give me both answers, from a kind of football supporters perspective and also from a media perspective, in terms of how easy it was to broadcast, how welcome you were made to feel by the staff of that club.
There was a lot of new grounds for me this season, so I think everyone was exciting, and even some of them that I'd been to a couple of times before, it's always nice to go back, because in the cases of many of them, I think apart from Brighton and Huddersfield, it had been a few years, so I guess that's the same as a fan. If you've been somewhere before, but a few years later, you probably look forward to it more than if you go every year. I really enjoyed Chelsea, because I was curious to see what it looked like. It's a lot smaller than it seems on TV. The food for the media there is particularly good, as John Anderson will tell you. And you just help yourself as many times as you want. Again, that's one of the perks that we're lucky to enjoy. Stoke, they filled in the corner on the far side, but there's something about it that, I was going to say, leaves you cold, literally, because it's not a warm place. But I think a lot of fans don't like the away section at Stoke. And that's, you know, it's on a bad working position. You're quite high up, halfway line sort of area, which is where you want to be, in the middle, high enough to see the far side of the pitch. It's better than being too low down. Yeah, that's probably one, I think, one of most people's least favourite ones. But it's a Premier League ground, and the facilities are pretty good, actually. And it's a relatively new ground, 20 years old. Best ground in terms of atmosphere. That's a tough one. I'll have a little think about that one. I'm sure I'll have one for you. Huddersfield was pretty loud, but it was their first Premier League match at home. Best place to work at, I think, is Leicester.
Yeah.
Because of the position that you're at and the room that you've got. And obviously, you know, we have notebooks and various things. Some, obviously, newspaper reporters have laptops, iPads, whatever. But you need a bit of space to write down. You need a bit of room either side to get out. If you do, we do Facebook videos with a tripod. So you need space to set all that up. Leicester are really good and look after you well from a media perspective. Wembley's incredible. We've been there for cup finals before, but I don't know how you found it, but it's, you know, you just wish it was a cup final.
I got a question for you about Wembley. So do the media have some sort of special train that runs to them, or do you have to wait for 2.5 hours like everyone else? I presume you're not going back into London. Well, I don't know, maybe you were going back into London, but did you drive? Did you? So
well, I'll tell you our pre-match routine generally in a minute, but no, Wembley, we got the train down in the morning. We were on one that was delayed. Might have been the one you were on. A lot of fans were on it. Just gave them the chance to open a few more cans, yeah. Which is fair enough. But no, we stayed in Wembley just because it's if you've got the train down, you haven't got a car to get back. And then we went back the next morning from Wembley up through King's Cross. But that is one of the downsides, isn't it?
Getting
away from a match. And when we leave an away game that we've gone to by public transport at 6 o'clock on a Saturday, we see that, we feel that as well. That's tough, isn't it? Waiting in queues, especially when your team's lost, being crammed on a train as well. But Wembley's incredible. We are on the side, we're behind the benches to the right, but on the far side from the camera. So if you're watching TV pictures, we're sort of on the left. But decent position, but brilliant facilities for the media. Just that one about atmosphere. Because there have been a lot of matches where it goes quiet. And that does happen. But Huddersfield was particularly loud. West Ham was difficult because it's so open, and there were some empty seats near us.
Although Brighton was good, there's no way you found Brighton's. I mean, particularly in the second half when they scored, that was pretty loud. I was not a huge fan of, you know, it's another ground that's miles away from everywhere in terms of the city centre and where we were staying. I drove back after that one, actually. But yeah, Brighton, I think Huddersfield, Si, you had a bone to pick with that.
We're convinced, I don't know if we've ever had it confirmed, we're convinced though that some of that crowd music was being played through the speakers at Huddersfield.
Seriously, yeah.
And there was definitely a drum that wasn't being played on a drum.
There was no drum next to us, but there was a drum, and we're like, is that coming through the speakers? We've never seen it confirmed, just be us.
Well, we didn't see a drummer either, but maybe.
It's been done before, we're convinced that the crowd noises were being added to by more fictional crowd noises.
Doesn't mean it still wasn't loud or good atmosphere. Yeah. I just think it's a weird thing to do by the club.
Yeah, the Southampton gave out clappers to the fans before the match,
right,
and put them out on the seats. And I think if you need to do that, then perhaps there's an issue with generating noise and excitement.
Leicester City have kind of killed that though, haven't they? Because they had clappers the season they won the league, and it's hard to criticise after a team's won the league by creating that atmosphere.
I don't know if it was the atmosphere, like, but
well, you know,
might have been the really good footballers, good manager, but
Crystal Palace pretty loud. I think that's probably the noisiest. You know, when it got going, leaving St James's Park to one side, which at times this season has been deafening, and you know, you can't hear yourselves think, which is what that place is and what it should be. But yeah, again, an old ground that they're looking to, they've got the plans through, haven't they? It's been approved, the redevelopment of the main stand. So that may be will lose some of its character, but I'm sure it will look really nice. But I'm pleased they stayed up because that ground is, yeah, I mean, that's a proper football ground, I think. So that, yeah, in terms of atmosphere, probably the best. That and Huddersfield.
I have a question for you, which is very specific, and you might not remember it, but West Brom, I was listening to that from Poland to you and John, and there was a fan when Jacob Murphy failed to do whatever the fan demanded that he do, kind of, you could hear him audibly swear. Well, this is the true faith, but he said, "You're shit, Murphy," or something like that. Listeners are used to swearing on this podcast. And you had to apologise. So my question is that fan intentionally walked by you to kind of have that broadcast? Because there isn't anything else. Any time I've listened, and we were, me and Si were in Australia for the whole of the winter, pretty much at the Ashes, so we listened to a lot of games, which again, I've tweeted this, like, fair play to the club for putting out for free. Because we'd have been stuffed. Yeah. Well, wouldn't have been stuffed, would have paid for it, but the club probably know they could make some money out of that, but choose not to. Yeah, is that a problem where fans come and try and get something over the airwaves, or is that just some bloke who was lost? Who?
No, he was sitting next to us, sitting really? To our right, because where we sit, and if you know St James's Park, we're behind the benches. That's where radio and print media sit. TV, Sky, Match of the Day, or whoever else are higher up, just below the hospitality boxes, kind of behind where the directors sit, but still in the Millburn stand. So we are really next to fans in the lower section of the Millburn. So yeah, sometimes you pick it up because we have two headsets, so we can hear our studio, and we have a mic on there, and we have a third microphone for crowd noise, and obviously you just picked it up there. And if any swearing comes through, obviously we have to apologise. I mean, it won't be us swearing, hopefully, but it's a member of the crowd. I guess in a football match, you are probably going to hear things like that. But no one walked past. There was a really noisy, and there was a fan who I assume got director's box tickets for Christmas for the Manchester City match, because we'd never seen or heard him before. He was right behind us on the front row. And the language was colourful, and there was a lot of shouting, and it was a night game, so, you know, people have had a bit longer to enjoy themselves in the day, and I think we had to apologise a couple of times for that, but that's just what happens. Some grounds you are really close to the fans. At Bournemouth, I mean, we're almost sitting, there was segregation, but not much, and we're pretty much sitting next to fans, and Newcastle scored twice, so, you know, while you're there to do a job, and they had their glory in the second half when they scored twice, you know, you don't want to upset them and make eye contact with them and wind them up. So some places you have to be a little bit careful, but at a football ground, you're going to hear that kind of language, aren't you? The only place that someone's ever come up and shouted at us or shouted in one of our microphones was 4 years ago, Grimsby against Gateshead. Conference playoff semi-final, first leg, 1-1 there. Gateshead won, got to Wembley and lost. But a Grimsby fan, really upset that they hadn't won the first leg, was sitting behind us, shouting at us, telling us we're biased. Well, obviously we're there not to cover it from Grimsby's perspective. And this is a man who, by looking at him, was probably in his 50s, went and got our third microphone, one for the crowd noise, picked it up and just screamed, "Town!" Grimsby Town into the microphone, and then threw his arm in the air and walked off. That's what you get. So yeah, depending on where you sit, obviously you can, you know, fans can hear you, and you know, some of them can take exception to what you're saying, but you can also hear fans, and our microphones can pick stuff up. But I guess if there was swearing on our gardening programme on BBC Newcastle, it might be a bit sort of out of place. Not that there isn't any. But at a football match, you know, it's one of the things that you may hear. But no, he's just a regular who sits next to us.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, you'd like to think that any listeners are there to expect that, and you're not going to get complaints from.
It wasn't even the complaints aspect. I just, like I said, just interested in how people use the platform that they have through.
Yeah.
But no, apart from this Grimsby fan. No,
yeah, we definitely don't use this platform to swear.
Some people come up to us when we're talking on air and try to have a conversation with us, and then, you know, you obviously you're talking, you're on the radio, so you can't. You can't really break off from what you're saying to tell people, "Oh, sorry, we're on air here," because that makes no sense to the listener. So yeah, you have to kind of point at your mic and point at your kit and then get them to realise, and then they scurry off, you know, embarrassed. And yeah, that does happen.
Just conscious of time here, because we've had you for 40 minutes so far, and you've probably not been home for tea yet after work. But yeah, the ongoing contract situation for Rafa, and the news that Si here listened to your break on BBC Radio Newcastle about West Ham, just you knowing Rafa as you do and, you know, working with the club, where do you see this all? Would you, if you're a betting man, still expect to see Rafa Benitez at Newcastle come August?
I really want to say yes without having to qualify it. He wants to stay at Newcastle in an ideal world, but the sense that you get is that he will stay for this season and for longer if the conditions are right for him, because he was not happy last summer. He wasn't happy in January or last January either, and he cannot have a repeat of those transfer windows. Basically, he can't have another window like the last three. So that's why he's seeking assurances, guarantees, whatever. Because, yes, he has another year left on his contract, but he knows that other clubs would want him. And he knows that, you know, he doesn't need the money, personally. Let's put it like that. So why would he need the hassle and the stress of having to do a job that he doesn't want to do, in the sense that he doesn't want to just scrape into the top half again? He wants to take Newcastle higher. Now, if the club aren't going to give him the opportunity to do that, why should they rely on his goodwill and his relationship with the fans to keep him here? Because that would only suit them rather than suit him. Apart from his early days in Spain, he's not used to managing teams kind of in the lower section of a league table. And he wants to be back at the top, but he thinks he can do that at Newcastle if he gets sufficient backing and the trust as well to be able to carry out what he wants to implement. And what I mean by that is, last summer, he thought he was going to get more money than he did. He thought he was going to have more control in terms of having deals done. So Willy Caballero, the goalkeeper, went to Chelsea from Manchester City on a free. He thought that deal was done. But his judgment was questioned. They stalled and he went elsewhere. Now you can see, as good as Carl Darlow and Rob Elliott have been at times for Newcastle, and they're both really nice lads as well, and they are good goalkeepers, and Rafa Benitez recognises that. But the difference that Martin Dubravka's made is why he wanted a goalkeeper. You know, Sells had to go on loan and Rafa didn't want Tim Krul. And it was things like that, 5 weeks for Florian Lejeune deal to be done when he has a release clause that they know about, stalling, potentially missing out on players. If you are paying a manager of his calibre the money that you're paying him, why not trust him to do the best thing for the club? Because he's not here to waste the club's money. He's not going to get everything right. No manager, no chief scout, Graham Carr, got every transfer right, but you would back Rafa Benitez with his contacts and his knowledge to make good signings and get value for money. So I think he feels that he needs to be trusted and backed. And in terms of money, if he says, right, I want X, and the club say, well, we can't give you that, we'll give you Y, you know, he would work with what the club would give him. He would probably like to do some negotiating and meet in the middle, but he would work with what the club give him if he has the control over how it's spent. So if, and I'm just plucking this figure from the sky, if in total there was £90 million there, don't quote me on this, this is not the figure, I don't know. But if he wants three players for £30 million or six for £15 million, he wants the power to be able to go and make those deals happen, rather than have to have things referred up to Mike Ashley if it's a big purchase, or have his judgment questioned. And that's what I mean. Let him get on with it. Give him the money and give him the power to do what he wants to do. And if they give him a reasonable sum of money, because it was only about £40 million that they spent on fees last summer, I think maybe a bit more if you add the Marino permanent deal on, and then you let him spend what he brings in, and he could bring in probably £50 million again, maybe more, then you know, that might be enough as long as he can spend it how he wishes. So there are things like that to be sorted out, and then maybe it'll come to the contract. I don't think it makes any sense to sign before the window closes, because then he can see if the club have made good on their promises, which they'll hopefully make to him. But he would like to be here for the long term. Honestly, now I think he'll be here because of what he's started already, how much he actually wants to stay, but obviously he's not happy with the situation in terms of the talks. Clearly, he's exasperated, I think is probably a better way of putting it. He would like things to be sorted now. But I think his relationship with the fans is key, and you look at West Ham, out the frying pan into the fire, in my opinion. I don't know if that's the right fit for him. So I'm sort of erring more towards him staying at Newcastle at least for this season, but things would need to change and need to happen for him to stay for longer. But it's concerning, isn't it? It is worrying that we're in this position for the third year in a row.
I think the word's draining. To have to go through another summer of this, it's really wearing out. I mean, I think from my perspective, what I'd like to see is that the transfer window opens quite early, doesn't it? It's just a week or two away, or isn't it after the last game?
I think it's today, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, is it today?
Yeah.
We should be seeing Dubravka permanently signed any day now. Like, that would be a certain of intent. Yeah, okay, you were right about that one. Boom, we've got him in.
$4.5 million or something.
Exactly. It's a no-brainer. We should also be seeing things like Kennedy. We should be making moves now, making inquiries, asking, is there a chance? Can we get a bid in now? And if there was some of that movement going on immediately, you'd feel a bit more reassured that actually, well, the club are going to try and make this happen. And if nothing happens and if the Dubravka thing drags on, you're going to think, oh, here we go. So I just want to see some business or something happen before we kind of go on full break after the FA Cup and Champions League finals. Something that says the club are already acting on what they need to do to keep Rafa here.
It's about signalling their intent, isn't it? And that's what he's talked about as well, about wanting to know that the club shares his vision for the future and seeing that they are actually ambitious and want to do more than just finish halfway up the Premier League. And again, why pay a top manager handsomely if all you want to do is just be a mid-table team? He would say, well, you know, again, just to repeat what I've already, you know, mentioned, you've got him there, you know, utilise him and his experience and his ability, and he can take the club places that it hasn't been for a long time. But you're absolutely right. And he wanted players in, three or four players, last summer before pre-season started. Well, that wasn't the case. And I think it was only Atsu, who was there the previous year, who came in. I think with Kennedy, a lot depends on Chelsea, but I take your point about the principle of actually making... moves now, and he's got targets. They've got recruitment team and scouts, and you know he'll know who he wants. But if he doesn't know the budget, then that is a problem. So things like that need to be sorted, and they need to be sorted soon, because this has opened the door for West Ham, and they've put this statement out tonight. And I appreciate that when you listen to this, this could be out of date and we could all be wrong, and he could have signed a new 3 or 4 year deal, or he could have left for somewhere or nowhere. But you know, they're obviously sensing that there's frustration at Newcastle, so why not have a go? There's this release clause of about £6 million. Well, Premier League clubs can afford to pay that, can't they? So there's a way for clubs of getting him out of his contract. But he's loyal, he doesn't want to break a contract. And his relationship with the fans has been key. And West Ham in particular, with that statement, which I think the timing of it's interesting, but perhaps a little mischievous as well, because they know people are talking about Rafa to West Ham. So they put out a statement saying that they're very close to agreeing with a manager or appointing a manager with Premier League and European experience and success at the highest level. Well, Rafa ticks all those boxes, but then so does Arsene Wenger. And... Manuel Pellegrini and Claudio Ranieri potentially. So I think that's a little bit naughty, but you know, if things were right here, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. And that's why it's so frustrating. Again, he wants clarity, and it's, you know, 3 years in a row they delivered in 2016, that summer in the Championship, last year in Rafa's, you know, feelings, it was a disaster. He can't have the same again. But if they can just meet in the middle, then you know, I think we'll be all right for this year. But it is worrying. But this will always be here until the club is sold. That's the thing, and that's ultimately what I think would change the culture and the approach at Newcastle United. And I think most fans are in agreement on that, aren't they?
Yeah,
well said. Finally, to finish off, you're not going to Russia. No commentary coming from yourself?
No. I've been learning Russian for 2 years. I should have done Spanish, but I started learning before, obviously. I started following Newcastle every week. So, you know, I could probably get by in Russian. But no, I'll be watching it every match, hopefully, like I'm sure you will. You start off with that intention, don't you? And then when, you know, you have... I don't know.
When we're out after two games, it gets less exciting.
Well, you have, you know, what, I don't know, but Senegal against Iran or something, and they're probably not in the same group, and it's 0-0 after 80 minutes, and you think, no. But and our show on BBC Newcastle, Total Sport, stops tomorrow, Friday night, and then comes back on ahead of the season. So it is the time when things are scaled back a little bit, but obviously it doesn't stop because of transfers and speculation about clubs and things like that. So now the season's finished, it feels weird. I never enjoy this first week after the season finishes, because you feel like there should be a game at the end of it and there's nothing. And we've got the World Cup to tide us over, but nothing beats, you know, watching Newcastle United every week and following the club and you know, having a game to look forward to. So roll on pre-season in July with the friendlies, and roll on August next year. And, you know, let's just hope that the club's in the right shape to do that. You almost can't predict, can you, what it's going to be, what the lineup on the first day of the season is going to be. It's quite fun to try, but we always get it spectacularly wrong because there's so many unknowns at the minute and so many variables. It's a problem, but you know, it just can't come round soon enough. But the sense of unease about the manager's situation, you know, is awful, isn't it? It's awful, and that needs to be sorted out first and foremost before you can think about anything else.
Just quickly from me, you mentioned before how one of your questions to Rafa in Spanish was about whether he's going to be taking a holiday. Did he get an answer to that question? Is he going to give himself a break?
He just said, don't know at the minute. Yeah, it was a very short answer. Sometimes you get 10 or 20 minutes on Spanish politics or something that happened at school for him, or, you know, something about Liverpool in the Champions League. Or sometimes you just get a short answer. But no, he's, again, we all know how lucky we are to have him, and let's just hope that he's here for a lot longer. He certainly would like to be, but the ball's in the club's court.
Nice one, Matthew. Thanks very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure, and hopefully we'll speak to you again before the next year, which tends to be an annual thing, this.
Well, thank you for having me again, and it's been a pleasure. I know this is a very popular podcast in an increasingly competitive market, so thank you for having me on.